Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me very great pleasure to welcome you to this public lecture to be given by Sir Nicholas Goodison, who is currently chairman of the TSB Group. But he's many things as well. He's president of the British Bankers Association, director of British Steel, and a non-executive director of General Accident. And before his appointment to the TSB Group in January 1989, he was chairman of the Stock Exchange, a position he held for nearly 13 years, and indeed, I suppose, still really associated in people's minds with the Stock Exchange, because during Sir Nicholas's tenure there, he presided over a period of radical change. Indeed, he started his career in the Stock Exchange, becoming a partner of H.E. Goodison & Co. in 1962. But outside the financial services industry and the banking world, he has many other interests. He's chairman of the National Art Collections Fund, which is the leading national charity helping museums and galleries in the UK to buy works of art. He's chairman of the Courtauld Institute of Art, one of the University of London's Senate Institutes, and therefore a sort of honorary academic, almost. A trustee of the National Heritage Memorial Fund, vice chairman of the English National Opera, honorary keeper of furniture at the Fitzwilliam Museum, Cambridge, and many more similar posts in the art world. He's also, outside the banking world, written many papers and articles on the history of furniture, metalwork, ornaments, clocks and barometers, and has published two books. One, Ormulow, the work of Matthew Boulton, and the other, English Barometers, 1680 to 1860. So, I mean, you've paid your academic dues, no question. His title tonight is, I think, very appropriate for someone interested in barometers. London's future as a world-class financial centre, a positive programme, neatly encapsulates some of the pressures that there is on the City of London at the moment, and how appropriate to have someone who is interested in devices for measuring pressure to come and talk to us about the kinds of pressures that are facing the financial services industry in City. So, very great pleasure. I invite Sir Nicholas Goodison to deliver his lecture to us now.
Thank you, John, for that introduction. I must say it's very agreeable to be here this evening in this world-class School of Economics, situated as it is in this world-class financial city. My theme will touch on the three words in this school's title, but it does concentrate on the first, namely London, and on its international competitiveness in the provision of financial services. Now, London's future as a world-class financial centre has been a hot topic of debate for some years, and I've been lucky, as you said in your introduction, during my own career to have worked in the City of London while its institutions consolidated London's role as one of the three leading world financial centres, and incidentally the one with by far the most international outlook. I've also, as you said, been directly involved during many exciting years at the Stock Exchange in a constructive effort to help the overall success of London. And succeed, it certainly has. The achievement has been despite heavy odds. Who would have thought that London stood a chance after Britain's virtual bankruptcy after the Second World War? And who would have bet on London surmounting the barriers put in its way, and particularly the barrier of exchange controls, which no government had the courage to get rid of for 40 years after they were introduced as a temporary measure in 1939. London had prospered with the waxing of the British Empire. Who would have expected it to prosper after the end of empire and the end of imperial trade. Now, can its success continue? Well, many have expressed doubts, and I don't find that at all surprising. It's inevitable in this world of rapid change, instant news, and what I believe is stimulating uncertainty, that the continuing supremacy of anyone or anything will be called into question. People enjoy playing skittles. And I'm going to roll a few balls myself in a moment or two, but before I do that, let me describe London's achievements. We stand here today in what is unquestionably the leading financial centre in Europe, and therefore in our time zone. It remains so despite determined efforts from other national centres such as Paris and Frankfurt. And a few statistics will make the point. Taking 1992 figures, for example, London accounted for 27% of global foreign exchange market. That's an average turnover of nearly £400 billion, and the figure is somewhat higher today. By comparison, Frankfurt managed 5% and Paris 3%. The comparison is even more impressive when you realize that over the 3 years up to that year, London managed to increase its share very substantially. In euro bonds, it is the supreme market. The United States interest equalization tax in 1963, which was designed to limit foreign issues in the States, drove the euro bond market offshore, and London took full advantage of it and became the host market for most of the primary and secondary market. The London Stock Exchange is another example of the success which London has attracted and held. In 1993, 64% of all foreign equity trading carried out on national exchanges throughout the world was done through London. And it's been particularly successful since the reforms of 1986 in attracting business in European equities. The turnover in all foreign equities in 1993 in London was 1.7 times the combined total of New York and NASD, the two biggest exchanges in the States. No other market was in the race. And more than 90% of the global cross-border equity trades are done in London. Now, there are many other impressive statistics. London handles 20% of international banking transactions, New York only 8%. Lloyd's, all right, it's had its recent catastrophes. It's still the leading international centre for marine and aviation insurance. The London International Financial Futures and Options Exchange has 28% of the European derivative exchange volume, and the London Metal Exchange another 7%. So that totals 35% of world volumes. Now, reflecting the reach of London and participating in its markets, there are no less than 520 foreign banks established in London. And they include most of the leading banks in the world. And it's now become a truism to say that there are more American banks in London than there are in New York and more Japanese banks in London than there are in Tokyo. It's not easy to be clear on how many there are in Europe because the statistics aren't very precise, but the estimates are 170 in France and 150 in Germany. New York, about 340. In addition to our 520 banks, there are 173 foreign securities houses, underlining London's lead not only in securities but also in investment banking. So London's clearly seen by the world's leading financial institutions as the natural centre from which to carry out a large part of their trade. You saw the news at the weekend that Deutsche Bank, describing investment banking as an Anglo-Saxon activity, have decided to centre their investment banking in London. Now, its success in capturing a large part of the world trade in financial markets has important implications for Britain's balance of payments, for economic activity, and, of course, for employment. Now, what of the future? Now, there is room for doubt. and doubts have been expressed. And the one thing that can safely be said about the future is that it's uncertain. Conscious when I say that, I'm borrowing from Maynard Keynes, but he in turn borrowed from a long line of philosophers stretching back to the Greeks. Let me express four grounds for doubt. First, to sound again like an ancient Greek philosopher, this time Heraclitus, nothing is permanent and all things are in a state of flux. Putting that out more graphically, and perhaps in the role of a market practitioner who learnt a bit from Isaac Newton, what goes up usually comes down. There are plenty of examples in European history of great centres which, for one reason or another, did not hold their status. Florence, Amsterdam, Rome, and so on. Perhaps the most appropriate, as a comparison, was Venice, whose supremacy, based on its geographical position and maritime empire, did not survive the discovery of the route to the Far East round the Cape. And I can imagine a 14th century lecturer on the Rialto, not all that long before Vasco da Gama set sail, speculating that the sun was unlikely to set on Venice's supremacy, and that the combination of the strategic position on the overland trade route to the Far East and that great city's naval power would continue to ensure the Serenissima's prosperity. So whatever I say this evening, to summarize the first doubt, is said with a proper sense of uncertainty about the unforeseen. It may well be that some decades from now, a combination of ever more sophisticated technology, the erosion of London's advantages in the areas of regulation, transparency, and language, and the economic growth around the Pacific will draw financial business elsewhere. It may even be that there's some other cause that I've not mentioned, something that those of us watching out for London's future haven't yet thought of. Well, that may be, but it seems unlikely anyway during my lifetime, providing we play our cards right. And that brings me to the other doubts which must be expressed. So the second doubt about London's continuing supremacy lurks in the developing single market in Europe. There will continue to be a euro fight for the leadership of the financial markets in Europe and thus in our time zone. Now, there's no serious contender outside Europe in our time zone. Within Europe, Germany has the largest and historically the strongest economy, and within Germany, Frankfurt is the strongest financial city. It's very natural to expect a powerful industrial economy to produce a strong financial centre. Indeed, it's a mystery to many that Frankfurt's not already outstripped London, given the relative sizes of the German and the United Kingdom economies, and the story of the successful economic management in Germany since the Second World War. The recent decision to locate the European Monetary Institute in Frankfurt could also give that city a boost. But the truth is that much of the international financial business done by leading German financial institutions is done in or through London. And Germany itself has been slow to reform its highly regulated and fragmented financial markets. Now, in a number of ways, that's been to Germany's advantage. But the authorities have now detected the weakness, and not surprisingly, have been turning their minds to the inadequacy of Germany's capital markets. They've been taking steps to improve their competitiveness, including reforms both of the taxation of savings and of securities markets themselves. And their wish for reform makes the German government's approval of withholding taxes on external savings invested in Germany quite extraordinary. Well, then there's Paris, an old rival. Now, startling things have taken place in Paris. We saw a socialist government pulling down barriers to competition and opening doors to international financial business. To a large extent, that was sparked by the changes at the London Stock Exchange, because it became obvious that practitioners in London using the very accessible mechanism of the stock exchange's SIAC system, were attracting a lot of business in leading French equities. Up to 30% of business in leading French equities was being done in London. That didn't exactly please the French authorities. Now, the attraction of such business to London was one of the main reasons for the reforms of the stock exchange in this country. So it was all quite deliberate. And before 1985, Paris was a highly regulated marketplace, virtually closed to international competition. With the dismantling of exchange controls and credit restrictions and so on, and the establishment of a financial futures market, and the transformation of the Bourse, all that has changed, and Paris has done a great deal to try and stop the erosion of its securities markets, simply because, as we all know, the erosion of one market could well lead to the erosion of other markets in a national centre. Amsterdam, another old great rival, has done much to reform its markets to try and capture more international trade and stop the erosion of its trade away to London. In other words, other European centres have instituted reforms to pull down barriers to domestic competition as the winds of competition from London have chilled their markets. Now, they've got an uphill task, and they know it, to make serious inroads into London's advantage, and it won't be easy for them to catch up in a few years with London's culture of openness and risk-taking, nor with the heavy investment in people and technology, which is usually only feasible with an established degree of success. And the signs of protectionism are still there, particularly in a reluctance to deregulate retail financial markets and in the preference for protective cross-shareholdings and so on in continental European countries. There are also signs, as you all know, of a Eurocentric view, which is held by some European governments, which tends to neglect the world outside and which is sometimes reflected in the restrictive nature of European directives. As for the siting of the European Monetary Institute in Frankfurt, and by implication, the siting of an eventual European Central Bank, I don't see that as a decisive threat. As the United States demonstrates, markets don't necessarily throng around the headquarters of a central bank. It is, on the other hand, essential that the central bank should establish its own key market operations where the action is. New York's markets have not moved to Washington. The Federal Reserve Bureau has moved the biggest part of its operation to New York. But there again, on the front of Europe, London cannot afford to drop its guard, whatever the present favourable situation. Now, the third doubt centres on a subject which I've mentioned earlier. It's paradoxical that a capital market should prosper in a country where the industrial and commercial base is relatively weak. Now, one could write a book, and probably should, about how London has achieved its preeminent position despite the United Kingdom's poor competitive performance over a long period of years. In 1870, London's unchallenged supremacy in the international money markets wasn't at all surprising. It's been estimated that over one half of world trade was financed in sterling towards the end of the 19th century, and that was a reflection of the manufacturing and trading business control through London as the capital of the leading industrial nation of its day. In the 1940s, only 40% was financed in sterling. By 1970, the proportion had dropped to only 20%. Declining industrial performance and a very poor record of fiscal and monetary management did a lot of damage. There are now, thankfully, signs of increasing political understanding of the need to control inflation and to keep government expenditure within bounds. But even assuming that this new orthodoxy sticks, as I hope it will, can London's success continue if the United Kingdom doesn't pull up its socks and do better as an industrial nation? Well, that question may be rhetorical, because we've already seen a great improvement in the height of Britain's socks since the dog days of the 1970s. Productivity has increased to such an extent in Britain that we can now look our major European competitors in the eye. And inward investment has boomed, so much so that we receive over a quarter of all direct foreign investment in Europe, and rather more than that of Japanese investment in Europe. The revival of Britain's motor industry, aided by substantial Japanese inward investment, is only one of the remarkable developments that seemed extremely unlikely in the 1970s. But what if Europe itself should become uncompetitive, given its relatively high cost base compared with the thrusting economies of the East? Is that a serious risk? Well, of course it is. In China, India, and Indonesia alone, there's a working population of about 800 million people, and they're not paid very much. They're extremely competitive with European producers and manufacturers. And that fact has changed the international perspective. The economies of the Far East will occupy a greater and greater part of our business and therefore our social outlook. And the gloomsters argue that Europe may be in for a long period of steep relative decline during a time of somewhat desperate effort to try and fund the pensions of its aging population. That's not a very good formula if you're trying to form savings on which a capital market feeds. Europe's response to that, and I'll come back to this, must be one of constructive support of a free and open world trading environment. And while a share of global GDP represented by the OECD countries will surely diminish, we should remember that the overall size of world GDP will increase substantially. A relatively smaller share of a larger world cake will not in fact bring famine if pound for pound or ecu for ecu slice is actually larger. The challenge will be to assimilate change, to remain competitive in our chosen industries and services, and then to invest in products and services which are competitive on a world scale. And let's not forget that the fast-growing countries of the East will need capital and advice as they change from largely agrarian economies to more sophisticated industrial ones. I stress those opportunities deliberately. There's much to learn from the experience of the financial markets in the United Kingdom, which have prospered from an adherence to the principles of openness, of flexibility, and innovation. They've thus turned what might have been described as a perceived weakness into a great strength. And with a determination to equip our economies with a skilled mobile workforce, with labour and wage cost flexibility and modern technology, let's underline that, and cost competitiveness, we should be able to turn things to our advantage. In any way, the European marketplace, with a population of nearly 350 million people and a GDP very nearly equal in size to that of the USA, is huge. And if barriers to trade can be progressively dismantled and stupidities like the Common Agricultural Policy got rid of, I can see no long-term reason why Europe shouldn't prosper. The sheer size of the European economy will surely attract major investment. So I don't worry too much about that particular ball, the fear that London's financial leadership might suffer from either the USA's or Europe's relative economic decline. Indeed, I expect London to continue to benefit from its active participation in the development of Eastern economies and to act as the chief channel of Eastern savings into Europe and of Western savings and financial expertise into the East. Now, the fourth doubt about London's continuing supremacy arises from a number of domestic risks. I believe the most serious risk is that some future United Kingdom government may raise personal and corporate tax rates and thus deter investment by international investment companies in the skills necessary to develop business in London. Or it may introduce new taxes which would push business elsewhere. Tax rates in today's world, in which people and investment can freely cross national frontiers, have become a competitive issue. Skills can be driven overseas by unfavorable rates of tax. And if you want a prime illustration of how domestic tax rates can drive financial business to another center, you need look no further than the example I've already mentioned, the United States' interest equalization tax, which caused the growth of the Eurobond markets in London. Or a future government might introduce or reintroduce artificial controls, not perhaps as severe as the many bureaucratic controls before the 1980s, but enough to damage London's international position as a liquid market and to drive savings and practitioners elsewhere. Or government might impose too burdensome a regime of regulation, or it might swing to isolation from Europe, or adopt a less welcome stance on inward investments. And those are all points to which I will return in a few moments. Well, I think that's my game of Skittles. I think that's complete. I don't side with the doubters. If I did, I probably wouldn't be standing here today, although I recognize that there is substance in their doubts. And it underlines my point that London's continuing success cannot be taken for granted. We need a positive program to work on to ensure that we prove the doubters wrong. Now, I shall now give an outline of what I think that positive program should be. We start with three unquestioned building blocks, which are much to our advantage. Nobody can take away London's tradition of international trading. That goes back to the days of Elizabethan piracy and exploration, and has been successfully built through the days of profitable colonization and empire, and in the late 19th century, through the days of world dominance as a manufacturing and commercial nation. It's a tradition which will be very difficult to kill. To quote from the excellent paper produced by the London Business School in its City Research Project, London remains perhaps the only true world financial center. For both New York and Tokyo can be said to owe their size mainly to that of their economies and the roles of their currencies. London's position has been greatly helped by a liberal attitude to immigration. The city has constantly attracted talented people wanting to get away from instability, from religious and racial intolerance, revolutions and wars in continental Europe. Stability, tolerance and freedom are part and parcel of the United Kingdom way of life. Like all competitive advantages, they need to be nurtured. And I'm conscious that being somewhat surprised at the study produced by the London School of Economics recently, which analysed levels of political freedom enjoyed by other countries. It wasn't surprising that Iraq came 101st out of 101. What was surprising was the United Kingdom only came 20th behind such countries as Costa Rica, Portugal and Uruguay. And far more important, some way behind its major industrial competitors like Germany, the USA and France. We must be constantly on our guard against the erosion of our traditions of freedom and tolerance. The second building block is just as important, if not more so. We are blessed by the rotation of the earth. Whatever the economic strength of the Far East and of America, the fact is that London is waking up while Tokyo is going to sleep and is still active when New York begins its early trading. The scope for trade between the two as daylight moves westwards is fantastic. It's the sort of monopoly that old-fashioned industrialists dreamt of. And the third building block is the English language, now firmly established as the world language of business. And the other day I was talking to a prominent Japanese gentleman, and I said, what is it that leads the Japanese to prefer putting plant in England as opposed to anywhere else, expecting him to say your tax breaks, your countryside or something? He said, unquestionably, the labour force speaks English and we can communicate with them. Now, sturdy as they are, we cannot rely on those three building blocks to ensure our success. And the rest of my talk will dwell on other things that we must continuously work on to ensure London's continuing financial supremacy during our little patch of daylight. Let's start with the things that financial institutions can do themselves. At the very least, the managers of financial institutions must constantly refine and improve their resources. The skills of their people are essential, and that means continuous training programs and careful planning to improve people's skills and experience. Employment for life was, until quite recently, a phrase that had real meaning in the banking world, even in Britain. More appropriate in today's competitive markets is the phrase employability for life, since employment for life has gone out of the window. That phrase embodies the flexibility and mobility that will be in demand to an even greater degree in the future than in the past. School never finishes if you want to succeed. Other ingredients of success need no elaboration. They include skilled and determined management, a positive attitude to risk coupled with refined and reliable systems to control risk, and technology, and I do underline that word. That will require continuous investment, let alone, finally, a determination to provide the best possible service to customers and to work to the highest standards of integrity. Now, technology has a communal dimension. So the second feature of our positive program must be to ensure that the shared systems for the display of market information, for payment and settlement, for telecommunications, are and remain ahead of the competitive centres elsewhere in the world. Now, that duty devolves partly on financial institutions themselves and partly on organisations to which they belong, such as Apex and SWIFT or the Stock Exchange. It devolves partly on state-owned institutions such as the Bank of England and partly on third-party suppliers of services. But all of us have a collective duty as inhabitants of this country, and particularly as Londoners, to see that systems are continuously honed and ahead of the best in other countries. And I say that because technology can change a market incredibly quickly. Third, we need to operate a system of regulation and supervision which ensures the highest possible standards of integrity and transparency without driving the providers of services to other centres. Regulation can create restrictions. It can, if it's applied insensitively, impose unnecessary burdens on the transaction of business. It's important for a financial centre to be known for the highest standards of conduct and on transparency, in other words, reliability. High standards attract business and tend to keep away the business that you don't want. And there is no evidence that dropping your standards attracts good quality business. But regulation must be appropriate to the particular markets to which it's applied. It's not necessary to apply the sort of regulation appropriate to the retail markets in savings to the wholesale markets. A far larger degree of the principle of caveat emptor is appropriate to wholesale markets. Now, there's been much criticism of the tiered system of statutory regulation introduced into this country by the Financial Services Act of 1987. The criticism has concentrated latterly on the conduct of business in domestic retail markets, where some reforms have rightly been called for. But this isn't the occasion to comment on the application of the Act to retail markets, which would deserve a lecture in itself. And I want to say something about wholesale markets. The initial application of the Act threatened quite a bit of damage to wholesale markets, but fortunately this was understood after time, and much work has now been done to simplify the complex rule books which were at first brought into existence. It's essential, without relaxing standards of supervision, to apply the lightest possible regulation to professional users of the markets, consonant with ensuring the highest standards of integrity and transparency. And I, for one, regret the backward move by the stock exchange in reducing the transparency of the stock market by allowing market makers to delay the reporting of their trades. Now, that principle of the lightest possible regulation has been well understood by the Bank of England over many years. Looking ahead, I believe that a satisfactory system of regulation can indeed be built on the provisions of the present Financial Services Act and Banking Act, although as time goes by, both will probably need to be modified. There isn't any chance of any government finding time, in my view, to rewrite completely the bills for regulation. Recent events have suggested the Securities and Investment Board needs stronger powers to deal with malefactors, but this again is not the occasion to spell out amendments to the Acts. I'd rather set my sights on the longer term. There seems to me to be a useful distinction between the regulation of systemic risk on the one hand and the regulation of the conduct of business and the protection of the customer on the other. The oversight of systemic risk is the natural province of the Bank of England. It calls for lively and methodical cooperation between the banking supervisory authorities throughout the world, a desirable aim which is not being achieved fast enough to keep up with the dynamic changes in the financial services industry owing to the fragmented nature of regulatory authorities, not least in the United States of America. The protection of depositors, which is the principle underlying the Banking Act, should no longer be the bank regulator's prime concern. It's important, but it shouldn't be allowed to deflect the banking authorities from keeping their eye on systemic risk or to drag them into the regulation of the conduct of business. And since I believe strongly in not copying the United States of America, where there are far too many regulators, each fighting their own bit of turf, I conclude that in the long term, in this country, we need to work towards two and only two bodies, one supervising systemic risk on an international basis and thus supervising a range of financial institutions going well beyond banks, and the other dealing with the conduct of business and the protection of customers, mostly but not all, retail. It's perfectly possible, incidentally, within the statutory framework, to delegate to responsible lower authorities with a strong input from practitioners, and that's already permitted by the Financial Services Act. Now, that model of regulation I've just put forward is still some way off. So meanwhile, since there isn't much chance of substantial legislative change, we should continue to spruce up the existing framework and ensure that the regulators cooperate across frontiers and across financial industries, reflecting both the international nature of risk and the fusion of financial service industries. Fourth, and finally, with four pages to go, I come to the tasks of government, other than regulation. Now, it's government's task to set a framework within which enterprise can succeed. Excuse me. I shall dwell briefly on the positive programme in the fields of economic, fiscal and monetary management, taxation, trade, Europe and London's infrastructure. I've said there's only 4 pages, so while that could take 4 hours, it's not going to. I'm conscious that these are all contentious fields, and I can only express my own opinions and then wait to be demolished in question time. I've earlier given government a bouquet for the more determined policies on controlling fiscal deficits and defeating inflation. Now, these policies are not peculiar to the United Kingdom. Indeed, I can't remember such an encouraging time in the world's economic outlook in my career. I say that because stability is essential to investment. In this country today, we stand a better chance of non-inflationary growth than at any time in the last 30 years. And I hope government will persist with these policies, which can only be good for Britain's future and therefore for London's future. And I'm encouraged by the decisions to permit the Bank of England to publish its unexpurgated commentary on inflation once a quarter, and to publish the minutes of the meetings between the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the Governor of the Bank of England. Both those decisions make it very difficult for the Chancellor to alter short-term interest rates for purely political reasons. And that's an important change, bearing in mind the possible role that high levels of unemployment are likely to play in a general election. I only wish that government would reinforce its confident moves by making the next logical move, namely delegating to the Bank of England the operation of monetary policy. Another lecture. On taxation, I can be very brief because I've already virtually covered it. I've said earlier that corporate and personal tax rates need to be internationally competitive. Companies look very carefully at corporate tax rates when considering where to invest and where to be domiciled. They also look very carefully at personal tax rates because if they're not competitive, industry and commerce, and particularly trade and finance, which now has a highly mobile international workforce, will lose them to other countries. Government tax policy should have as one of its guiding principles the need to encourage the development of industry and commerce in this country. The promotion of international free trade is another essential policy. The protectionism has been shown to be a dead end. Competition is a lubricant of innovation and of the quality of service that leads to success. London's open door policy, and there's no question about this, which has dismantled barriers to nationality and to competition, has proved the point. One man's restriction is another man's opportunity, as we have seen again and again. Eurobonds, Japanese securities traded in London because costs too high in Japan and listing requirements are too intense and listing costs are too high, European equities traded in London, and so on. There must be no going back on this policy of open door. Britain's policies of supporting the dismantling of barriers to trade throughout the world and encouraging inward investment in this country has been and will be an important ingredient of success. Such policies need to be pursued vigorously within Europe to ensure that the European Union does not itself become Eurocentric and erect barriers to international competition and inward investment. And that brings me to Europe. Now, I've already said how important Europe is as a market. We should surely be positive about Europe. And that, to me, means two or three things. First, it means strong support for the implementation of the single market, and I don't imagine that will be at all contentious. Just as it's not in the interests of consumers throughout Europe that barriers to competition should remain, so it's not in the interests of financial markets that there should be restrictive legislation to protect domestic markets within Europe. Second, I think it means a greater commitment to the development of the European Union. Now, there are surely matters which are best dealt with at a European level, just as there are matters that are best dealt with at a national level or at a local level. And the debate on this issue becomes clouded by political infighting and the liberal use of abstract nouns such as federalism, subsidiarity, and sovereignty, which mean different things in different languages. Parliament, in my view, should not be frightened of delegating decisions either upwards or downwards. We should concentrate more on defining those areas of decision that should be delegated upwards or downwards, and that, in my view, implies constitutional reform both in Europe and in this country. The third, under the heading of Europe, I think we need to move more positively along the path towards a single currency. I believe it will come anyway as trade develops within the great European market and producers and consumers increasingly see the nonsense of dealing in one marketplace in 12 or more different currencies in the conduct of their day-to-day trade. So I'm reasonably confident that politicians will follow. Now, European Monetary Union will not be achieved on the timetable, which was very artificial, laid down in the Maastricht Treaty. But governments should continue to work on the prospect and attempt to achieve the necessary convergence of economic and monetary policies in order to implement it, even if some countries would not be able to join such a union in the initial stages. Perhaps naming a date sufficiently far ahead to be practical would concentrate people's minds. Monetary union is seen in other European countries as a very serious prospect. The United Kingdom should remain firmly within the circle of European nations which are considering it. It will do us no commercial or financial good to be left out. And that said, I do see the need for institutional reform as part and parcel of the way forward. I've left the physical needs of London to last. Here again, government has a positive role to play. You cannot achieve the leadership of any market without the best communications, particularly telecommunications and transport. The efficiency of London's infrastructure should be a high priority on any government's agenda. Now, I should add, so should the quality of life in the capital. People don't live or visit London only to do their trade. They come here to enjoy life and to benefit from one of the most fascinating cities in the world. London still enjoys the confidence of the world's businessmen. In recent surveys by the Financial Times, London again came out as the first choice of city for the location of a business. Paris and Frankfurt are the next most preferred European locations, although I'm glad to say their standing relative to London has slipped somewhat since 1993. The advantages cited by those businessmen are numerous: tax, regulatory regimes, government, language, culture, telecommunications, availability of expertise and staff all appear at the top of the list. In other areas, I regret that we conspicuously fail, and the most often quoted criticism is transport. There may be some lessons to learn from competing cities in the overall coordination of the many strands of life across the capital. There should be more debate, therefore, about how we could manage London better. And the creation of a government office for London was a welcome declaration of the government's intent, but I imagine we would all agree that more remains to be done. In conclusion, business flows to the most liquid, the most efficient, the best regulated centre. Users of markets know that in such a center they will do their business quickly, efficiently, and securely. In today's world, capital moves freely across frontiers, and advanced technology can rapidly undermine the standing and value of any particular location. It would be very easy to lose the race in today's competitive conditions. Now, I've argued that London has three building blocks which make a firm foundation: its international tradition, its place in the world time zones, its language. But I've also argued that a positive program needs to be built on those foundations to ensure London's continuing success. None of us can see far into the future, but I believe that London can continue on the basis of such a program to maintain its leadership at least as long as Venice managed it, and can avoid for a long time that beautiful city's inevitable, if romantic, decline.
Well, Sir Nicholas has said that he'd be prepared to answer questions. In that very encouraging lecture, I thought, Sir Nicholas, you only missed out one possible part of your positive program, and that's to have an even better school of economics in your chosen city. But I look forward to enlisting you in that, in support of that aim. But now, there will be a reception in the senior common room in 10 minutes or so, but we have time for questions until then. If I could ask you to put your hand up. Yes, sir.
John, I'm involved, in fact, in politics at a grassroots level, and very briefly part of England, in fact. There is a great difficulty. I totally agree with the speaker about the necessity to go for a common currency, but there is a great deal of difficulty in selling this concept at the grassroots level. I think it might help if perhaps few words were said about what would happen if Britain lagged behind and did not, in fact, join right at the beginning with the founder members a common European currency.
Well, I think that, and I prefer to look at the positive side, which is that I think it is a matter of great convenience, and I did say that I thought it would be the grassroots that would eventually put pressure on achieving it. I think small business, for example, particularly, would find it of enormous advantage to not pay the banks quite so much. I'm very selfless, unselfish on this. Not pay the banks quite so much to transact business into 12 different currencies. And if you're making mugs in Stoke-on-Trent, I think you would find it somewhat easier developing export markets into Europe if you didn't have all these different currencies. I think that's grassroots stuff. I think similarly, all the people who travel to one or more countries will find it enormously convenient if they didn't have to change currency and book it 3 days ahead with their branch bank and so on and so forth. I don't believe these practical advantages have actually been talked about. I haven't seen them during any of the political debates. On the negative side, I think if we're not in there planning this particular move, we stand a very great chance of being on the sidelines when it actually comes. Now, I'm not saying by that London would necessarily cease to be the leading center where foreign exchange would continue to be transacted, because there will be three great world currencies, and I imagine if it can keep its skills, it would still carry on doing that trade. But I think it's like nails in the coffin. I think once you start eroding something, you can't foresee the future. So in my book, on balance, I think I'd rather avoid that negative possibility. I did say the future is uncertain. I could argue, I suppose, or put forward a respectable intellectual argument that London would continue to do very well if it was outside, but I don't actually believe it. I believe it would do better if it was inside. I've deliberately ducked answering the possible political nature of your question, because I hope I answered it by inference in my talk. And by that I mean that the implications of a single currency for the transfer of resources from one part of Europe to another or for the fiscal regime in Europe are very large. And that has been talked about. But I did say that I would hope to see some institutional reform in Europe, because I see the two very much linked.
Okay. It's at the back, sir.
Sorry, I can't quite hear.
How important do you think it is that the city of London remains a unique part of the local authority? And should its boundaries be altered for some advantage to the city?
I don't think the two subjects...
Hear the question at the back?
Well, the question was, how important is it that the City of London, that's the Corporation of London, should remain a unique, and I think you said powerful authority. I think powerful, you meant rich. Should its boundaries not be altered? I'm not sure I've really got a strong view on this. It's been a very successful local authority. It has been instrumental in furthering the success of London. It's been instrumental, I think, in managing its affairs really very well. It's non-political, as you know, and has not suffered from internal political fighting. There's been a very common view that roads need improving and bridges needed improving and so on and so forth. It's got a good record in things like education. So it's a successful local authority, whatever you think of its very archaic and rather unsatisfactory electoral procedures. I think I would like it to survive. I think I would like it to change its electoral procedures, and I'd like to see less pomp and circumstance in its public events, because I don't think that gives the right message across the country. I very much welcome its very cooperative, outward-looking stance to its neighbouring local authorities. And you may not be aware that it is actually putting resource into neighbouring local authorities, both real resource and personal resource. And that's a very good thing, I think. But I think it comes under the heading of, if it works, don't change it. Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir.
Among London's advantages as a share market, you didn't mention the fact that in Europe it's by and large the only market-making system. Now, do you believe in the future of this system as he's going for London's future? Or do you think it might be usefully complemented by a continental-type national system?
Oh, I think that's purely a question of practicalities. You can't actually make people become market makers. It's a purely voluntary thing. Nor can you force people into a system of matching trades. Again, it's purely what the practitioners will do. There's no doubt whatever, though, that London's flexible market-making system in securities, that's both bonds and in equities, has attracted business, because it's added a huge element of risk-taking to the market that didn't exist elsewhere. And market makers are prepared to take risk in large numbers, which a matching system simply can't provide. But you will see changes, because there will be changes of practice to reflect the needs of the market. I'm not, therefore, directly answering your question. I'm saying business is dynamic. And I think there's enough innovation and risk-taking in London, a willingness to have a go, to devise any system that will attract business.
One final question. Yes, at the back there.
Don't you think that because in the economy, UK economy, there's no level of saving compared to the Southeast Asia, don't you think that inevitably, in the long term, Britain, because of its low savings, can't sustain its position?
Yes, I did say a few words about that. The question is, are we not under threat in the United Kingdom? I think perhaps you'd even add Europe, wouldn't you? Because the totality of savings here might look extremely small in relation to the totality of savings in the East. Is that what you were saying? I did mention that, of course. And I think it is a real risk because, well, let's take London first. One of our advantages I didn't mention in my talk was that we do have funded pension schemes in Britain. That's undoubtedly helped the capital markets to do better because there's been a ready source of institutional savings to channel into industrial enterprise. And it's not true, of course, of France, Germany, and other continental European countries where pensions tend to be funded by cash contributions during the year they're incurred. Nor are there large funded pension schemes in the Far East. That's a peculiar London advantage. That will go on, I think, but we have to look at the threat of an institutional market growing up in other centres. On the broader front of your question, yes, I do think that is a threat. I think the huge prospective flow of savings in the Far East, particularly in countries like China, will establish other centres as important channels of savings. Against that, I would expect most of those savings to be absorbed by the countries in which they're being created. China's going to have fantastic demands on its savings markets to spend on its infrastructure and so on, which is very out of date and not at all able to sustain a modern economy. And the same is true of India and other Eastern countries. And what I did say in my talk was that providing London can keep its skills, it can, of course, export them. And you're already seeing London firms very active in the Far East advising those governments and institutions on how to apply their savings and how to channel them into productive investment. So I think it's the skills that matter, and that's still here.
Indeed, in this very institution, if I may underline Indeed. The point, Sir Nicholas.
I mean, the reason I didn't say that, of course, it's important to have a better London School of Economics is I can't actually imagine a better London School of Economics.
Oh, I can.
Except in County Hall.
Yes. Well, it falls to me now, I think, to thank you on behalf of your audience, Sir Nicholas, for having given us a splendid synoptic view of how you see London's future. And if I may congratulate you on having given us a much more positive and upbeat view of that future than one often sees in the press or indeed in some other political circles. And let me too end on an upbeat note and invite you all to join you in an informal reception in the Senior Common Room, which for those of you who are unfamiliar to the school is on the fifth floor of this building. It can be reached by a very antiquated and cumbersome lift system, which we really ought to improve. Thank you very much.